Key, we've just come through an election, and the dust is beginning to settle. But in the country's first 100 years, it seems we kicked up a lot of dust because there was no secret ballot.
Yeah, this would probably surprise a number of Americans who assume things like this have not changed over the course of our entire history. But for the first century in the United States, Election Day tended to be a big party, and there was no secret ballot, and so people could write on any scrap of paper, or ballots were supplied by the parties or were available from the local newspapers. And so that meant lots of opportunity for corruption, coercion, intimidation. By the end of the 1800s, some of the states were realizing that perhaps a secret ballot would be a good way to deal with that problem of corruption. And the first president elected by secret ballot was Grover Cleveland in 1892. And in researching that story, I found an article written by a Harvard professor about the balloting process. And she points out that by 1896, Americans in 39 out of 45 states cast secret government-printed ballots. The turnout nationwide, 80%, which was about what it had been since the 1830s. It has been falling more or less steadily ever since. And I think that's kind of an unusual and interesting fact, that the secret ballot has actually caused voter turnout to go down.
Yeah. How did you come to research that particular question?
Well, I started out the research for the book by just kind of making a list of facts that seemed interesting to me and that I thought perhaps would be interesting to other people as well. And so some of them are based on actual questions that we have answered for NPR journalists, and some are just things that I learned and, you know, living in the world and paying attention to what happens around me. And politics, American politics, is something I've always been interested in, and I've done lots of work over the years with the Washington Desk reporters and editors, and there are a number of facts in this book that I borrowed from Ken Rudin and his columns or his appearances on the radio. And that was one that I thought of on my own, and the fact that Ken Rudin didn't realize how late in our history the secret ballot came in made me think that this would be a good fact to tell everybody else about.
Yeah. Another thing I was surprised by, and here is another of the many wonderful surprises in your book, that the first foreign head of state to visit the U.S. made his visit actually quite down the line in 1874, the Merry Monarch. If you'd flip to page 30, there's the Monarch.
Right. And of course, today we wouldn't think of a visitor from Hawaii as a foreigner. But of course, at that time, Hawaii, which was also known as the Sandwich Islands, was indeed a foreign nation. And I got this information from the U.S. Senate, who keeps track of such visits. And I guess that until 1874, when he came to visit, the other countries just didn't consider us important enough to have a state visit. And of course, it wasn't as easy to travel back then as it is now. And so now, of course, having foreign heads of state visit the U.S. is a fairly common event. Hmm.
Scott Simon interviewed you recently, and he said the librarians at NPR don't wait to be asked. It seems that the library staff are digging up interesting ideas for reporters to pursue all the time. Can you tell us about how that works?
Well, you know, as I say, if you live in the world and you're paying attention to what's going on around you, you're going to learn a lot of interesting things. And I think all of us, and of course I am only one of the team of librarians here, all of us keep in mind that, you know, the interests and the specialties and the expertise of our hosts and reporters, and you come across an interesting little story idea, and so you might think, that would be perfect for Scott Simon, or that's something that Don Gagne would want to know about. And so that's one of the ways in which the librarians are proactive. But that's definitely a basic part of any librarian's job, is to think about your patrons and to try to anticipate their needs.
And is Scott Simon's nickname Scooter?
It is, and that's from when he was a little kid. Oh. And he is occasionally
called himself that or referred to himself on the air that way. So, yeah, I think I did say hi, Scooter.
It was a charming interview. NPR is celebrating 40 years now. Was there a library at NPR from the get-go?
Absolutely. Actually, the very first person who was hired at NPR was, I think they called her an information specialist, was a researcher, a woman who whose job it was to help reporters find interesting story ideas and whatever information they needed to go out and cover them. And from that one person in the very early 1970s, when we first went on the air, by the mid-70s, it had grown into a real library with a book collection and magazine subscriptions. And also from the very beginning, we had a broadcast library where all the finished programs are cataloged, are archived and preserved, and metadata is attached to the information, and they can be retrieved, and all things audio and video are curated there, and music librarians are there to give people advice on using music in production. And so, yes, right from the very beginning, NPR has had that kind of really strong information support.
You've included in the book a note from Alex Chadwick. He wrote that he really wanted to use something in his story, but his cherished fact could not be established, so it was left out. How much time might you spend tracking down a fact, and when do you call it a day?
Well, sometimes the deadline is what's imposed by the journalist, that they've got only 10 minutes before they do an interview, and you put together as much information as you can in a brief period of time. But it does happen that information just cannot be nailed down to a level where you feel comfortable giving it to the journalist and telling them it's okay to go ahead and use that. And so sometimes our advice is, well, I couldn't find that piece of information, but would this work? Could you work this into your script, or could you rewrite and say this instead? And so we do sometimes work very closely with them and try to figure out what's the most accurate thing that they can put into their script.
We can track information down at our desks now so easily thanks to the internet. Has that had an impact on the number of queries you get?
Well, yes and no. Yeah, I mean, you're right, of course. There's a huge amount of information that's available to you. But what's the quality of that information? How much of it is really ready for you to just turn around and put it on the radio? And so librarians can help to sift through the huge amount of results you might get in a search engine and help you to evaluate what are the right sources, what's a comprehensive, current, up-to-date, complete story versus just, you know, some little fact that you find in some guy's blog. And that shouldn't be sufficient for a journalist, of course.
Yeah. Librarians, the very best editors, I think. What do you think?
Well, in some news organizations, actually, the word librarian, you know, has connotations of sensible shoes and, you know, an old lady sitting at a desk. And so some people are changing their job titles and, you know, maybe we should be called research editors because that is really what we're doing. We're sifting through material, we're compiling, we're trying to anticipate people's needs and put information together in advance. And so it is very much like the rest of the editorial process.
Well, whatever you call yourself, live long and prosper.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, Key.
You're welcome.